running through the third chapter of 1 Corinthians, a passage we've been spending some time with over the last couple of weeks. We see a series of metaphors or analogies related to the church of Jesus Christ. These metaphors relate to the building up of the church, building upon that one foundation as we sang in that hymn earlier in our service. Paul has been using throughout this section the indefinite pronoun, and we said that this indicated that Paul is referring to anybody who builds upon the church, anybody who builds upon that foundation of Jesus Christ. They need to be careful, Paul says. Care must be taken, because those who build upon the foundation using gold and silver and costly stones will receive a reward in the end from their Lord. On the other hand, those who are building upon the church and they are using wood and hay and straw will watch as all of their efforts and all of their work go up in flames at that testing by fire at the end. We also notice finally in that section that those who actually bring harm to the church can expect to receive harm from the Lord. It said there in chapter 3 that any that would destroy the church, God will destroy them. Those are pretty serious words. Now, while these verses can be applied to anyone, and we have been drawing attention to the indefinite pronoun being used throughout, the primary application in this section is the apostles. It is the recognized church leaders there in the city of Corinth. We will see in the latter verses of chapter 4 that the apostles and the recognized church leaders were the objects of focus throughout much of the section. In fact, the chapter 4 will close with a rather interesting distinction that Paul draws between the apostles, with himself as an example, and those who were presenting themselves in the city of Corinth as the legitimate church leaders. Now, Paul's going to point out that they weren't really the legitimate church leaders, but that's how they were presenting themselves. But today we're going to start chapter 4, and we see there at the beginning of chapter 4 that Paul puts forth a challenge or a charge to the believers. He actually uses the imperative or the command form of the verb, and he wants the believers to consider or to look at the calling and the ministry of the apostles of Jesus Christ. This is how Paul starts off. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning at verse 1. This is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Now let's begin today by looking at some of those terms that Paul uses for himself and the other apostles. We're going to start with a short word study on the English word for servant seen there in verse 1. There are actually three words in the Greek language that sometimes are translated into our English Bibles by the word servant. The first word is the word doulos. This is the word for a slave or a servant in the sense of being the property of the owner. In fact, Paul describes himself as a doulos of Christ, a doulos of God in the opening of many of his letters. Romans chapter 1, verse 1, Paul says, I am a doulos of God. Titus chapter 1, verse 1, Galatians chapter 1, verse 10. The term draws attention to the idea that Paul belonged to Christ. Paul belonged to God. I like that term because in the sense we were bought with a price. We are not our own. We belong to another. Now, the second term used for servant in the New Testament is the word diakonos. This term refers to someone who willingly submits himself to the master or to the task. While the term doulos refers to someone who does not have freedom but belongs to, the term diakonos refers to one who freely submits himself to the master. Our English word deacon comes from the Greek word diakonos. And Paul uses this term for himself in scriptures as well. In fact, just last chapter, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 5, we read where Paul said, "What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants. Servants through whom you believed as the Lord assigned to each." But now as we come to 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1, we notice that Paul doesn't use these first two terms, even though these are the more common terms. He doesn't use the word doulos or diakonos to describe himself, even though he's used it other places. He uses actually a less common word, but a word that has some interesting meanings. What he uses is the word huperitos. What is that? Well, literally, the word huperitos means the under-rower. What's the image behind that? In the Greek and Roman world, they had large galley ships that were used to navigate the Mediterranean and the other bodies of water there. And in these galley ships, you had several rows of rowers. You had some rowers that were either on or just below the deck of the ship. You also had rowers sometimes under them and sometimes even a third level under them. So the huperitos was the under rower. He was the lowest slave there at the very bottom of this row of slaves. It was an interesting position to be in because you couldn't see where the ship was going. You didn't know if your life was in danger because of the battle. You just simply had to sit there in the very bottom of the ship and listen to and trust the master who would call out to you your instructions. If the master said pull, then you pulled. If the master said rest, then you rested. And you had to simply trust the master and you had to follow carefully the instructions of the master as he called the different sides. He would call one side to pull and the other side to rest. And if you didn't do that correctly, the ship wouldn't go in the right direction. Paul uses that word, huperitos, to describe himself in our passage this morning. I like that image of the servant because it points to the fact that we are not in control. The Lord is in control. He calls to us, he gives us our charge, he gives us our command, and our job is to labor and work as the Lord commands. We submit to the direction, we submit to the commands of the master. We have to put our faith and trust into the hands of the master. And that's a bit of what it means to be a follower of Christ, trusting and putting our trust in him. Well, looking back now at that verse, chapter 4, verse 1, we have another term that Paul uses to describe himself. This second term is the term oikonomos. This is translated in the ESV as the word steward. This word literally means a household manager. The oikonomos was a slave or a servant who often was given great authority and great responsibility to oversee the household of the master. I think of Joseph. Joseph would have been this kind of a steward. He was a slave to Potiphar, but he was also someone highly skilled and greatly trusted by Potiphar, and so he was placed as a steward over the house of Potiphar. Now, a steward does not own anything in the house. The master owns everything. But all of this is entrusted to the steward. entrusted to the household manager. I think it's interesting that Paul uses these two terms, huperitas and oikonomos, here in the same verse. One term refers to the lowest galley slave, the one with no authority, no control, just simply having to trust and obey the commands of the master. The other term refers to the chief slave of the household, one with great authority, one with great control. Now, because the steward has such authority and control, he had to be greatly trusted by the master. This is just what we see in our passage as we continue this morning to verse 2. Moreover, it is required of the steward that they be found faithful. One of the most important characteristics of a servant is faithfulness. The apostles were given great authority, great responsibility over the mysteries of God, and they had to be found faithful in those things. We discussed the idea of the mysteries of God in our study of the book of Ephesians. The mystery of God is the very plan of God, the salvation plan that He decreed from the very beginning, but that He waited and made known in the coming of Jesus Christ. The mystery is the revelation of Jesus Christ. The apostles were considered stewards of this mystery. In other words, the apostles had great responsibility to manage, to control, and to distribute this mystery all over the world. The master also will hold a steward accountable for the distribution and management of the household resources. Likewise, the master will hold the apostles responsible and accountable for the distribution of the very mysteries of God. Now keep in mind, here in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1, the focus is the apostles. But I would venture to say that we could find many other passages in the scripture which bring this same responsibility upon us. We have been given the very mysteries of God. We have been given the charge to take this message of salvation to all the world, the great commission of Jesus. Go and to all the world, make disciples of all nations. I think of Acts chapter 1, verse 8. You will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you shall be my witnesses here in Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, and then to the uttermost parts of the world. As we prepare our boxes for distribution, we are indeed participating in the distribution, the spreading out, the taking of the mysteries of God into all the world. Next month we will have our focus on Lottie Moon, and we will, as a church, begin to prepare ourselves, and we will begin to give of our resources for the distribution of the mysteries of God. We are stewards in that regard. And just as a steward is to be found faithful in carrying out his authority and fulfilling his responsibilities, we as a fellowship, we as God's people, need to be found faithful in our fulfilling of the commission, fulfilling of the task in the management and distribution of the mysteries in God that have been entrusted to us. Faithfulness is that primary characteristic that God desires from His servants. If you recall, in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, a passage we looked at a couple of weeks ago, we noted Paul's words where he said, I planted, Apollos watered, but God brought the growth, God brought the increase. So, neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. He who plants and he who waters are one. And then here's the focus for our thought this morning. And each will receive his wages according to his labor. In other words, we will receive rewards from God for faithfully planting, for faithfully watering, for faithfully doing whatever it is that God has called us to do. We are servants. We are stewards. And we will receive our rewards for faithfully doing the things that God has called us to do. Now keep in mind that we do not receive rewards for the results. We do not receive rewards for the increase. That is something that God does. In fact, if you focus on the results, there are two possible dangers that could come from that. You could either get a big head because you think the positive results are a result of your efforts. This could actually lead to a bit of spiritual pride. We could also get discouraged thinking that the lack of results is a result of our own weaknesses, our own deficiencies. But the truth is, neither would be the case. God doesn't call us to be concerned about the results. He calls us to be faithful. The results, the increase, that is what God does. Our task is to be faithful in doing what God has called us to do. And as we saw when we looked at chapter 3, we do need to be careful and mindful of how we do our work. If you remember, we are to strive to build with only gold and silver and costly stones. I think it would be safe to say that God has an easier task of bringing about the increase when we are careful to build with gold and silver and costly stones. Likewise, if we are building with hay and straw, you know, God can still bring about the increase. God can do anything and accomplish anything that he desires to. But we may be making it a little more challenging for God to bring about the increase if we either don't do our work at all, or if we do our work but we're building with hay and straw. Another thought to consider is that God may be bringing about his increase through our work. God may be bringing the increase on a new mission field as missionaries are sent, as missionaries are being supplied and financed by the churches back home, as those missionaries go on to the field using techniques and procedures and ministry that is effective, that is gold and silver and costly stones. If missionaries don't go, or if they go but do their work primarily with hay and straw, the yield may be low on that mission field. Let's take the same thought into the Sunday school classroom. The increase, the spiritual development of the students is the work of God and God alone. But God is able to use a skilled teacher who has come into that classroom with teaching techniques and teaching materials that could be characterized with gold and silver and costly stones. You see, our responsibility as stewards, as servants, is to build with gold and silver and costly stones and allow God to bring about the increase and the results. As we move on in our chapter here, we see that Paul will move to a new topic, the topic of judgment. And this topic relates to some of the themes that we've already addressed there in chapter 3. If you recall, in chapter 3, we saw that the testing of fire will come when the Lord comes. And that testing of fire will be a testing to test the quality of the building materials that the servants have been using. The gold and the silver will be shown to be of the highest quality of building material because it survives the testing of fire. It's not burned up in that testing. On the other hand, if you recall the hay and the straw, these things are destroyed. It's destroyed by the fire. And when the master comes, the worker who has been building with hay and straw will stand before the master with embarrassment. So the element of judgment is seen there in chapter 3. We also will see at the end of chapter 4 another theme of judgment. Some in the church of Corinth apparently were being rather critical of the Apostle Paul and actually judging the Apostle Paul. And Paul will offer an interesting compare and contrast between himself as an apostle of Jesus Christ and these others in the church who seemed to be critical of Paul and judging Paul. But that is a passage we'll look at another time. Let's look and focus in on today's passage. What is Paul saying for today? He says that he does not want to entertain or to be troubled by the judgment of those in the church that seem to be judging Paul. He does not want to be troubled or concerned about the judgment from the human courts. And he doesn't want to be concerned about his own judgment. Let's look at, see how Paul puts this in verse 3. But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. Again, we're going to save that little phrase, being judged by you, for another message. This idea of judgment by a human court, the second judgment that that Paul is addressing here, well, this is rather easy to understand. If you recall, throughout the first three chapters of 1 Corinthians, Paul has been showing that human wisdom is quite inferior to God's wisdom. In fact, when human wisdom considers the message of the cross of Christ, we learn that they see it as simply foolishness. Why would Paul entertain the opinions of a human court when the human wisdom of the human court would see his commitment to the cross as foolishness? When we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 2, we noted that the man without the Spirit of God could not even discern spiritual things. Paul is declaring spiritual things in the city of Corinth. The only way to understand such things is to have the Spirit of God dwelling within. Now, the believers in Corinth, they had the Spirit of God. But the human courts, they would not. And so why would Paul be concerned what the human courts say about his ministry and his message? But why is Paul resistant to submitting himself to his own judgment? That seems rather strange. We can see why he would not concern himself with the judgment of others in the church. Paul will address those individuals in chapter 4, showing that their judgment is not really a good judgment. They're not really in a position to judge. We can see why he would not be concerned about submitting to or being concerned about the judgment of a human court, because again, those in the human court are not in a position to judge Paul. But why can't Paul judge himself? Well, the answer is Paul does not want to judge himself because that is not his role. He is a servant. He is a steward. It is the Lord who is the judge. The servant only serves faithfully. In fact, this is true as a general principle. The master determines what work is to be done. The master determines the quality of the work that is required. It is the servant who simply does the work to the satisfaction of the master. Applied to the work of the church, it is the Lord who calls each one of us to our places of service. It is the Lord who gives spiritual gifts to each one of us to accomplish the things that God has called us to. It is the Lord who determines the quality of the work, and it is the Lord who will test that work in the end with the testing by fire. Our job is to simply faithfully fulfill the work that God has called us to do. We, as servants of God, may sometimes think that we're doing a fine job. We may think we are building faithfully with gold and silver and costly stones. But as our passage this morning points out, we may actually be building with wood and hay and straw. If this is the case, when the testing of fire comes, we may be rather surprised that all of our work is destroyed in that fire. Why? Because we honestly believed all along that we were building with the good stuff, when in fact we have been building with inferior materials all along. We have the capacity of self-deception, thinking that we are doing a good thing when in fact we may be building with hay and straw. Just because we think we're doing fine, that doesn't mean indeed that we are doing fine. This is how the Apostle Paul puts it in verses 3 and 4. I do not even judge myself, for I am not aware of anything against me, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. The NIV translates that middle section a little bit differently. NIV says, my conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It's an interesting thought. Again, just because we think we are doing fine does not mean that we are doing fine. It is the Lord who sets the standard. It is the Lord who evaluates the work. Now, we do need to strive to build with only gold and silver and costly stones. But it is the Lord and His testing by fire in the end that will determine if indeed we are building with gold and silver and costly stones. We often hear today that we must follow our conscience. But it is not our conscience that determines what is right and what is wrong. It is the Lord who determines right and wrong. Now, if our conscience has been shaped by the Spirit of God and the Word of God, we may have a rather accurate measure of indeed what is right and wrong. But remember that the conscience itself is not the standard. Someone could have a conscience that is shaped and influenced by things other than the Spirit of God, other than the Word of God. Maybe your conscience is shaped more by Oprah than Obadiah. If that's the case, it's going to have little help in guiding us into the truth. A good conscience is like a soft pillow, as the Proverbs go, but that pillow may be a pillow of self-deception. This principle should cause us to reflect. It causes me to reflect on our work for the Lord. Actually, another application would be our interactions with one another. We do have the tendency of viewing ourselves as doing pretty good. We have the tendency of taking our own side in our interactions and our conflicts with other people. But we could be wrong. And the work that we are doing could be a little suspect. We need to allow the Lord to be our judge, and we need to exercise a little bit of humility in our interactions with others. Just because you think you are in the right does not make you in the right. We are all going to be judged by the Lord, by the Lord's standards, and not our own. Paul concludes this section with these words, "Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes," or as the NIV translates that word, "the motives of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God." This thought reminds me of another reason why the Lord and the Lord alone should be our judge. Only the Lord knows the purposes and the motives of the human heart. We do not know the purposes and the motives of another man's heart. Only God does. And God will judge those motives along with the actions. In fact, we don't fully understand and know our own motives, our own purposes at times. Only God does. We need to add this element of motives to the element of quality that we saw back in chapter 3. If you recall, the quality of our service was described as gold and silver, or hay and straw. And here in chapter 4, we learn that God is also concerned about the motives and the purposes of our heart in our building. Both seem to be very important. Sometimes we have the best of motives, but we may not act on them. Or we may not perform the right actions, or we may sometimes perform harmful actions. Our motives may be good, but our actions are a little suspect. And other times we may do all the right things, but we don't have the best motives in the doing of those things. Again, as we see here, as we bring chapter 3 and chapter 4 together, we see that God is interested both in our actions and in our motives. Sometimes we excuse people if they have done the wrong thing, but they've done it with right motives. Again, God is interested in both. In the end, we will receive a reward from the Lord if we have both built with gold and silver and costly stones, and that we've done that building with the right motives and the right purposes. The Lord is concerned about why we do what we do. Likewise, we sometimes are able to fool each other sometimes when something is done right, but they have the wrong motives. Since we cannot see the motives of the human heart, someone could fool us with some good actions which actually stem from wicked motives. But God is not fooled. He wants both right actions and right motives. And in the end, those who have right actions and right motives, they are the ones that will hear from their master, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Come and enjoy the happiness of your master." God is concerned about the motives of our heart. He is concerned about the purposes of our heart.